and welcome back to the weekly Bunker Roundtable. I'm Ros Taylor. Coming up in today's edition, the Church of England has got involved in the row over sending migrants to Rwanda. We look at the details of the plan, Britain's decidedly ambivalent attitude to refugees, and what theology can bring to this debate, if anything. Plus, Johnson is very sorry for breaking the law, but he didn't realise he was doing anything wrong. How long can that defence hold, and will the public punish him in May? And as the cost of living crisis bites, which streaming services will be the first to go? All that and more in this week's Bunker. Welcome back to The Bunker. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, you can keep us going by backing us on the crowdfunding app Patreon. You'll get the shows early, ad-free and exclusive merchandise when you back us for as little as £2 per month. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast. There's a link in the show notes too. Now, let's meet today's panel. First up, hello to commentator, actor and cook Alex Andreou.
Hello.
Welcome back to The Bunker.
Thank you.
After celebrating Easter his own way over the weekend, more on that later, the Minister for Government Efficiency, Jacob Rees-Mogg, has ordered civil servants to get back into the office. He says too many are working from home. Why does he think this is so important to the public?
Yes, so the haunted pencil has apparently written to all departments asking them to press employees to get back to 9 to 5 at their desk. Sir Graham Brady chipped in with, "It is simply unacceptable for so many of our public servants to continue sitting at home," which implies they're not doing anything. What's interesting about this, I thought, is the reasoning they gave. So Rees-Mogg wrote that departments must, and I quote, "ensure we are making efficient use of the central London estate." And number 10 confirmed that departments, and I quote, "should have maximum use of office space and progress is being monitored." So there's no criticism of productivity or efficiency. In fact, the Institute for Government published a study a couple of months ago saying this could be a great boon for Whitehall because it would allow the government to cut costs. It would improve retention of people. They could hire further afield and they could start to move departments out of London, which is their stated aim. But no, the approach seems to be, we have the office space, we need to fill it.
But the fascinating thing is, they don't even really have the office space. I mean, my fiancé is a civil servant, and she was working at home today because the department that she works for has 3 times more employees than they have
desks.
I know,
they're hot-desking, aren't they?
Absolutely.
But what I think is interesting is that this is the man who's tasked with finding Brexit opportunities. So on the one hand, we have this rhetoric of Brexit opportunities that are all, you know, a modern, lithe, flexible UK that will make most of fintech and AI. And on the other hand, we have this Elizabethan popinjay complaining that he doesn't see enough children up chimneys.
Well, this is the thing that surprises me in a way, because it's actually a very anti-motherhood policy, this. And you'd think that Jacob Rees-Mogg, of all people, with all his many children, would be keen on this. It makes it much more difficult for women to work when they can't do the school runs. You lose a huge amount of time out of your day trying to get to school and back. And when you add on that commute, it basically becomes impossible to work for a portion of the day.
It's a massive win-win for government. I really don't get it. I mean, the only thing I can imagine is that ministers must feel less powerful when they walk through the open plan and, you know, there's not loads of people in tiny little booths there sort of, you know, scratching away at the books looking for tax shelters.
Like Scrooge's clerk.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry. Also joining us, we have comedian and broadcaster Ahir Shah. Ahir, welcome to The Bunker.
Hello.
You have just become an uncle for the first time, is that right?
I have. It's been very exciting. That's happened since my last appearance on The Bunker, and I've been spending as much time as possible with my sister and brother-in-law and the wonderful little Raffi, who is the smallest and cutest and loudest and smelliest thing I've ever seen in my life. So that's been wonderful. But it's been another thing that, you know, I've never seen something so small that required so much ancillary gear just around around the place. Like, this guy's got a lot of accessories, you know. And I was talking to my brother-in-law about this the other day when he was just saying, like, no element of this is cheap. And that's the line that's really going to stick with me throughout it. And at a time when you've got, I mean, the ever-increasing pressures of housing, the fact that energy bills are going up tremendously, the fact that conversations that I have with people, particularly in their early 20s, are now everyone's understandably pranging out about the interest rates that are going to be applied to student loans. And then you think you sort of get all that, and then you get to the position where you're starting a family. And it's at all of these points in your life where you're doing these spectacularly capital-intensive things, and everything around just seems to be conspiring against you. It's baffling to me the extent that we don't support young people who are doing everything that we say that they should be.
Right? I mean, I'm just wait till, you know, the childcare kicks in, because if I'd had any idea how much that would cost when my first child was born, believe me, the kid would have been sleeping on a blanket. I mean, there would have been no cot, no bouncy chair, none of that rubbish. No. So don't let your don't let them spend too much money on that, is my advice. Right, our special guest today is comedy writer Jason Hazley. Hello, Jason.
Hello, folks. I'm sorry to be joining you remotely, but your producer forgot to invite me to the studio.
Well, we're very sorry about that. Next time.
I'm making the most of my maverick status here.
Your work includes a series of parody Ladybird books and scripts for That Mitchell and Webb Look, Charlie Brooker's Screen Wipe, and the Paddington films. There's a lot failing in this country at the moment, but you were particularly exercised this week about the state of Oxford Street. What's wrong with a bit of tat?
I walked up Oxford Street last week, and I've lived in London for, I think, about 30 years, and I don't think it's ever looked worse. It looks like basically London's spinal column has had some kind of catastrophic injury. It's a mess of new builds of varying quality, boarded up places, and then these tawdry little shit shops of which used to be kind of people saying, come and get a bunch of, you don't know what it is in a bag, but it's only £30. It might be a nice deodorant in there or something. And now it's these sweet shops which are selling overpriced, apparently out of date American candy. Private Eye have been running a series of pieces about them, and they are basically just the work of one person who has a string of company liquidations behind him. He sets up a company, he sells this stuff, he runs up enormous debts, and then he liquidates it.
For years, the government has been trying to work out how to stop migrants from crossing the Channel in boats or hidden in the back of trucks. More than 28,000 made the journey in small boats last year. Some, of course, didn't make it. Now Priti Patel believes she's found a deterrent to fly all the men who arrive to Rwanda, which has agreed to put them up until their asylum claims are processed. Note that the men will not be allowed to seek asylum in Britain. It will be up to Rwanda to accept them or not. Alex, Priti Patel thinks this will stop them setting off in the first place. But Matthew Rycroft, the permanent secretary at the Home Office, warned her that it wouldn't. Has anything like this been tried before?
Actually, no. There have been a handful of cases of offshoring the asylum process, as it's called. So Australia started placing asylum seekers in detention centres on Nauru and Manus Island in 2001. Then they stopped in 2007, restarted in 2014. It has seen a few thousand placed in detention camps at the cost of $12 billion over 8 years. Importantly, up to three quarters of asylum seekers being held in Australia's offshore camps were ultimately determined to be refugees. The Open Society Policy Institute has looked at the Australian scheme and found it has had zero effect on overall flows. So, I mean, it fails at sort of every test. But I say there hasn't been a scheme like this one because even in those offshoring schemes, they're still processing their application for asylum in Australia. They're not processing, you know, they're not farming them off to Nauru and say you can apply for asylum in Nauru, which is what this scheme does. This scheme takes people wanting to apply for asylum in Britain and says, no, you can apply for asylum in Rwanda to Rwanda. So nothing like this has been done before.
Why Rwanda? Other countries refused this glorious opportunity, didn't they? But why did Rwanda go for it?
So Rwanda did a similar deal with Israel between 2014 and 2017. And it resulted in 98% of the 4,000 people sent to Rwanda just leaving straight away and trying to make their way back to where they were headed in the first place. Denmark signed a similar deal with Rwanda last year. And as far as I can see, they haven't relocated a single asylum seeker. So why not? It's free money for Rwanda. They're like, yeah, sure. If you want a virtue signal to your, or rather the opposite of virtue signaling, vice signal to your voters that you're tough on refugees and pay us a few billion for the privilege, go for it.
So Rwanda does not really want to accept these refugees, and most of them are from the Middle East. So it's a bad fit culturally, Rwanda. In any case, is the country just planning to pocket the fee the UK provides and reject the applications and fly them back to their home countries? Or
I don't know. I mean, I think all of it is performative. I think it's a sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You know, we're not going to send anyone. You're not going to give asylum to anyone. It's just so we can calm down the racists in our country, basically. You know, people become asylum seekers for all sorts of reasons. So, you know, there are people, there are teens fleeing the Taliban because they're LGBT+. I mean, just imagine crossing a continent as an LGBT teen, coming to this country and being told, you kind of look over 18, so we're going to send you to that beacon of LGBT freedoms, Rwanda. It's not a good look, is it?
No. I hear the Archbishop of Canterbury waded in on Easter Sunday. He said the plan couldn't stand the judgment of God. And the Church of England and the Conservative Party used to have a special relationship. Is that changing?
Well, I think what's interesting is that the sort of shape and face of religiosity in Britain is changing, and has changed quite drastically, even over the last few decades, right? And we think about the Church of England and the Conservative Party perhaps having some sort of relationship because we think that the Church of England is sort of like jam and cream scones on some village somewhere. I never leave London. I don't know why I'm claiming to know what happens in villages. But first of all, there was a fascinating piece that I read over the weekend, which was drawing attention to the fact that London is by quite a considerable margin the most heavily religious part of the country. Generally speaking, members of ethnic minorities are considerably more religious than the white British population, everything. So if the Church and the Conservative Party are having their relationship sort of changed, I think it's because the more religious elements of the society in contemporary Britain might actually demographically be more likely to be Labour voters now.
And Jacob Rees-Mogg, I'm sorry to bring him up again. we won't try not to do it again.
You should be.
And then he intervened and he backed Johnson naturally. He's not CFE. He's a Catholic, like Johnson, as it happens. He said the Rwanda plan was an almost Easter story of redemption. Tell us about the theological reasoning here.
Well, you know, I am not a Christian other than the inevitable Christianity that seeped into me through socialization in this country from the moment of birth. So I don't know if I have exactly the academic theological background to critique Mr. Rees-Mogg on that. I think that what the fundamental reasoning is what perhaps the most useful thing that religion has provided in the thousands and thousands of years of human religion existing, which is providing a justification for that thing you wanted to do anyway, right? I think that Mr. Rees-Mogg thinks that shipping people to Rwanda would be a jolly good idea. And consequently, of course, there is nothing in the slightest in the Bible that could possibly suggest any different.
Well, it certainly wasn't something that came up in my CFE primary. But when religious leaders of any stripe get involved in politics, I mean, should we listen?
I think that that's an interesting question because it very much depends on the sort of country that A, you are, and B, that you want to be. Right. So with a country like the United States, for example, which has far more sort of public religiosity than we have in this country, but is explicitly founded on a secular basis, the whole idea would be, well, in that instance, if, I don't know, the Pope would have some comment on what's going on in the United States, they would say, well, no, we have a strict separation of church and state, and that's got no business getting involved in this. The idea of an Archbishop of the Church of England not getting involved in politics in a country where you have bishops sitting in the House of Lords, you have an officially established church, you have a monarch who, whether we like it or not, is the monarch who we are subjects of and is defender of the faith and everything. Religion is already heavily politicized, and politics is in some ways religiousized, or how would you say? And so these things are intertwined. And so I don't think it's legitimate to be like, oh, well, what do you know? You're an archbishop. Stay in your lane and stop, quote unquote, virtue signaling, as though that weren't the only job of an archbishop.
Stop sermonizing.
But it is worth then asking, well, do we want to live in a society in which religious leaders have a political function? Because currently, as it stands, we do.
Jason, this comes as Britons are being urged to welcome refugees into their homes, providing that they're Ukrainian and you can get through the complicated bureaucracy required to let one into your home. What do you make of these mixed messages?
Well, I think we can all see what's going on here, can't we? Mixed is an interesting word because it doesn't obviously apply to the skin colour of the refugees. My partner is involved with a refugee charity locally, and they've helped welcome a couple of Afghan families to the area. But a lot of the work has been done on WhatsApp groups because the overall infrastructure is rubbish. The government is very slow to inform the local council of what they can and can't do. The local council is understaffed on the number of people who are working on getting refugees into housing. There was an instance of a family, mum, dad and kids, who came here. The dad was a translator in Afghanistan for the army, and they came here in August last year. They spent 6 months, the seven of them, I think it is, in one hotel room in Leicester. Then they came to London, but they were put somewhere with no other Afghans around them, which means that you can't – this is a slightly difficult concept to get your head around, but if you want to integrate, you have to have people with whom you can integrate, right? So if you're the only Afghan family there, it's like being an audience of one when the person on stage says, come on, join in, like you're not going to do it, you know, because you're alone. So you need that kind of support network. They didn't have them. Eventually they were put somewhere where there were other Afghans, but it then took 6 weeks to get the kids into a school place, meaning that the dad, who was the one English speaker who's desperate to work, couldn't do any work. And it's like the entire system is just not functional. Everything is too slow. Everything's too difficult. And like my local council has six homes currently ready to resettle Afghan families, but they're all empty because the infrastructure won't get the people into the homes quickly enough. So they're sitting in hotels somewhere.
One of the things I wonder is whether the experience of helping these refugees will bring home the cruelty of the way we treat refugees to a lot of people who haven't experienced it firsthand, secondhand, or even thirdhand before. And whether that will be a lasting legacy of this. It'll be fascinating to see. But when you were working on the Paddington scripts, were you very conscious that Paddington is a refugee? Because it's something that comes through quite strongly in the film.
Yeah, it was absolutely front and centre. I should say I'm not listed on the writing card of the film because I was part of what was called the Brains Trust that did the very significant rewrites when it was clear that the film wasn't quite ready for release. But there were about 10 of us. But yes, one of the biggest changes we made to the scripts is that this is the first film. Nicole Kidman was the baddie. And the baddie in this kids' film was a dead-eyed, beautiful scientist who wanted to kill the bear, eviscerate it and stuff it. And it was generally agreed that that was quite a difficult concept for kids to get their head around as a baddie, not to mention utterly grotesque. So it was decided to retilt the film along with some reshoots to say that the real baddie should be, this is basically the story of an outsider who needs a home. So the real baddie should be, what if he's got nowhere and he's got no one? Because that plugs straight into separation anxiety, which is one of the first and most fundamental fears that any child has. Like, I've got nobody. So it was decided to tilt the film in that direction. And I should say also, this was all being done, this was done in spring of 2014, which was right on the slick. The whole thing was written and rewritten on the slick of that that came out of the 2012 Olympics. And just the joy of how welcoming and universal and colourful the UK could be. I mean, imagine. It's extraordinary to think we're only 10 years out from that now, isn't it?
Alex, Priti Patel hit back at the weekend against the Archbishop and critics. She said critics of the scheme had no solutions to this problem. Is there a solution to the issue of channel migrants? Because more and more are crossing each year. It's not a problem that is going away. Is there a humane way of handling this?
Yes. Safe and legal routes and timely processing of their claims. All of these contortions are to do with the UK trying to evade its responsibilities under international law. The alternative is not fucking doing that. If the international conventions on the treatment of refugees and asylum seekers are no longer fit for purpose, by all means, make that argument. Get together as an international community and craft something that works for everyone. But don't, you know, try to basically wriggle out of your international law obligations and then say, well, it's very difficult. We're finding it very difficult to do it. You know, ultimately, the only long-term solution is to tackle the underlying reasons that create population movements, war, poverty, environmental damage. So we as a country can't sell arms, cut international aid, ignore our commitments on the environment, and then complain that people are trying to move away from the hell that we create for them. There is no system that will stop that. There are no borders that will stop that.
Theresa May, who's not known for being particularly soft on the issue of immigration, intervened today, didn't she, in the Commons?
Yeah. It's an interesting intervention, like many interventions from Conservative backbenchers who are against this. It was about its cost and efficacy. And I have to say, Priti Patel was on a really, really difficult wicket on those issues because it looks like it's going to cost an enormous amount of money and not work. So it's just a senior cabinet minister in a lot of trouble having a last throw on the dice, like a teenager hasn't tidied their bedroom and, you know, their ultimate solution is to go, I'm doing it, I'm doing it.
Well, Boris Johnson has given us a full apology. He knows people have a right to expect better from him. That said, he didn't realise that his parties were against the law. MPs are now going to vote on Thursday on whether Johnson should be referred to the Privileges Committee over whether he lied to the Commons about parties in Number 10. It's not a vote of no confidence, but some Tory MPs might be tempted to signal their unhappiness. Meanwhile, what did you think of Johnson's performance, shall we say, in the Commons today, Alex?
So as we're recording, it's emerged that Mark Harper has written to Sir Graham Brady and published his letter of no confidence. That's quite significant because he was a chief whip under Theresa May. And he is someone that the government trusts quite a lot. I mean, they were putting him up for the media round like 4 or 5 weeks ago, around the spring statement, and he's published a pretty scathing letter saying, you know, integrity is what you do when no one is looking. I'm sorry to say that you no longer are worthy of the great office you hold. He doesn't mince his words. It was a bad, bad performance for Johnson. He tried to do sort of 30 seconds of the apology and then go on to how terrific he is leading the world in on Ukraine and doing all the stuff that he's not doing on the cost of living, but it just didn't wash. And Keir Starmer, I think, came back with the best speech I've heard him give since he became Labour leader 2 years ago. He absolutely made mincemeat of him. It was embarrassing to watch, actually.
I hear. What did you think of Starmer?
I'm much agreed on the speech, and I would recommend to any listeners who haven't watched it already to do so. Starmer, I think we know that he doesn't do sort of relaxed particularly well or funny particularly well or what have you, but it very much played to the strength of the things that he actually can do. And, I mean, he's in a situation where he's opposite someone who is entirely bang to white. So, like, it's nothing that he was saying wasn't true.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is what made it all the more... And, like, you know, and makes it all the more ridiculous when he still gets pulled up on, and could you please withdraw the word dishonest because it's not parliamentary language. It's like, I kind of vaguely understand why that convention exists, but come on.
Yeah, the Speaker said he had to. The Speaker said he should work around it.
yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think also it comes from an authentic place for him, which always helps. Mm. I think he's genuinely a by-the-rules person. Mm. So it seems to me that someone behaving like Johnson behaved is a genuine affront to his sensitivities. So it comes from a really real and deep place for him.
Yeah. A huge part of the sort of sadness that a lot of people, I'd say this is certainly the way that I felt, and I think that a lot of people felt when the sheer extent of everything that had been happening in Number 10 throughout the period where we were being instructed under very harsh sanction to behave a certain way, is that I sort of felt like I'd been made to feel a mug, and no one likes being made to feel like these people were living it up and laughing at them. Yeah. And that's exactly like, oh yes, of course you little people thought that it was for you. But yeah, I can genuinely imagine a lot of MPs being genuinely quite shocked when they found out that, what, you were just like every night you were all getting smashed and like hanging out.
I don't have that many parties in a normal year, let alone during lockdown. This is upsetting.
Starmer had a very good line about taking on this defence, if I can call it that, that Johnson supporters are using about the speeding ticket analogy, which they say, you know, it's like a speeding ticket. Not that it's not very serious and much more serious, but it's like a speeding ticket. And he pointed out that he'd actually prosecuted Chris Huhne, the Lib Dem politician, for a speeding ticket in the past. Does it cut through with people, though, this particular defence?
I think the speeding ticket... Look, I've already heard the speeding ticket defence in the wild once, but admittedly, I heard it from someone who the only thing that he likes more than Boris Johnson is teasing me about how much I hate Boris Johnson.
I thought you were going to say speeding.
And, like, of course, like the speeding ticket thing doesn't stand up to a moment's scrutiny, because it's not like, you know, I received a speeding ticket once when I was going slightly above because I was driving my wife, who is in labour, to the hospital or something, and it's slightly different to... No, every night I go out to see how quick I can go in my new Lambo. Sometimes it's not enough to do it at night. I'll just do it at 3:20 outside the school, actually, because that's something that I'm into as well. And by the way, no one else is allowed in a car, because it would impede, any sort of traffic would impede
and
my ability.
And I'm drunk.
Yeah, and I'm smashed. The child swings out of commission. Let's get the foot down on the accelerator, guys.
But Starmer was very good on that today, wasn't he? He demolished that with the flip of it, which is that no one came to me in tears because they weren't allowed to do 28 in a 20 or whatever it was he said. So he actually turned that into a serious issue, which was very clever of him, I thought. And I've never seen him more pissed off. And I think he should embrace his anger more in Parliament. I do worry about the language, though, because things like the speeding penalty and ambushed with cake and even the word Partygate, right? It's not about the parties. It's about the lies. That's the thing. And Liegate, unfortunately, doesn't scan very well, and it also sounds like some shit bit of software from the 90s. But above all, the thing is that all this stuff drags the story away from the context, and the context is, and Starmer got this right today, the degree of sacrifice being made of people, it was absolutely skyscraping. You know, there were those adverts that said, if one person breaks the rules, we all suffer. Well, by Johnson's own argument, he was breaking the rules, thereby causing everyone to suffer. The Prime Minister was causing everyone to suffer.
And in fairness, we have suffered. So,
yes.
Yeah,
and I mean, the point is that if you look at all the research done on compliance with the rules at the time, it was always much higher than even the models had expected. Yeah. And if you flip that and say, if everyone had behaved like Downing Street had behaved, we're talking about 50,000 more dead. That's what we're talking about, effectively. You know, we're talking about a lot of people dying.
I mean, when you put it like that, it is quite bad, isn't it?
It is quite a lot worse than a parking ticket, isn't it?
Jason, Johnson supporters hope, though, that each time he gets fined, and we are expecting two or three, maybe more even, fines for other events that he attended without realising they were parties, that we will get a bit more desensitised to the fact he broke the law. That's the hope. Do you think it will work like that?
Well, they're such a dreamers, aren't they, Johnson supporters? I mean, Edward Lee is so full of dreams that he's turning purple. I think there are two ways that this plays out, and it's not an either-or. Basically, we're sort of currently in an abusive relationship with our government, right? Johnson said today that he feels an even greater sense of obligation to deliver on the priorities of the British people. I think that's what he said, having been found guilty. This is nonsense. This is like saying, yeah, but he always tells me he loves me afterwards or something. So these repeated abuses, right? He lies. They obviously cause some people to sort of dissociate and go numb and get desensitized to it. But, and possibly at the same time, the other thing is that this stuff piles up and piles up. And assuming there are more fixed penalty notices, Johnson starts to look like the Archbishop of bullshit, basically. And that gets people pissed off when they just see they're being lied to repeatedly. A Labour canvasser told me today they've been going around for the local elections, doorstepping, and they've said, we've had so few conversations about council tax, which is the usual thing, but we've had lots of conversations about giving Johnson a kicking. So this stuff is seeping in, you know? It's like Mother Shipton's well. The water drips down and drips down and drips down. And after a certain amount of time, something is calcified there. And I think that's what's going to happen with Johnson.
Well, the war in Ukraine seems to have given him, or he believes it's given him, a new lease of life. What does it mean, though, for an PM to hang his reputation on a war in which Britain will not, arguably cannot, play a major role? Has he gone as far? Has he taken this as far as he can with Ukraine? Because now that Russia as well is attacking in the east, and this could go on for a long time. Is it really a strategy that's going to work for him?
I can't see that it can. I mean, it's just the kind of squalid thing you'd expect him to do, to be honest. We know who he is. He's an opportunist. He does not take things seriously. No one's going to fall for this, you know, that he's some kind of war hero here. It's just bullshit. And especially next to Zelensky, who's powerful and steadfast and passionate, and in his fatigues, he looks like a wartime leader. He looks like the kind of leader who would actually go and be at the front with the troops, whereas our Prime Minister just looks like something tied to the radiator of a bin lorry, you know? I mean, he's not a serious human being. He's not a serious leader, and I don't think he can suddenly dine out on just coupling himself up to a war which he's on the right side of, coincidentally.
I think that Boris Johnson does look like a wartime leader, but it's the wartime in a children's film and we're at war with some naughty elves.
Ahir, do you think he gets away with it because he's Johnson? Are we still enthralled to him? Or is it because there has been a palpable shift in the standards we expect from politicians? You could see Starmer trying to drag it back today and saying, you know, the British people want to get back to a government that has values. Have we switched, or is this just the exceptionalism we will only put up with it from Johnson?
Maybe we need to go a step back, because in stating that he does get away with this stuff in the first place. I'm not actually sure that that's really true, unless we're defining it as he gets away with it in the sense that, yes, he woke up this morning as Prime Minister and will go to bed this evening as Prime Minister, and that continues for a while. You know, but that's not like some sort of like grand cackling victory after you've vanquished all of your foes and named World King or whatever he would quite like to be. You know, we are going to have elections very soon across the nation where I think that he's going to get a massive electoral kicking. His entire governing project, despite a gigantic majority that has not been seen in a very long time, seems to be trapped entirely in amber and unable to enact anything. So it's like, I would just query, to, when we say that he keeps getting away with this, or like, to what end? To do what? To just to carry on being called Mr. Prime Minister tomorrow? Then yes, maybe he does get away with it for a little bit longer because more Tory backbenchers are entirely spineless than aren't. But I don't think that he gets away with it in the sense that, you know, it's not like 95% of the country are still like, oh, Bozza, what a top bloke, and we're all shouting into the ether. This is a spectacularly unpopular man who's about to get an electoral drubbing.
I guess the point is that when the only other option is complete defeat, then deferral feels like victory. Mm. You know, like living to fight another day feels like a massive achievement. But you're right. I mean, he's dead man. I genuinely cannot see him going back to the country and asking for its vote, publishing a manifesto, making promises. You know, the point you were making, Jason, about, you know, being in an abusive relationship. Stephen Baker of the ERG fame just asked him in Parliament, will you please promise me nothing like this will ever happen again?
What?
And Johnson didn't. And Johnson actually wriggled out of it. And it's like, that is an abusive relationship, isn't it? That is the partner going, oh, you will change, won't you?
Wait, this won't happen again. Does that mean that Johnson is in an abusive relationship with himself? In which case, should we be pitying him in some way?
Someone said that, believe it or not. A Tory MP stood up and said that the country should show more compassion to the PM because he's having a very difficult time.
Oh, fuck off.
Seriously, Edward Lee, I think it was, the one that goes purple.
Of course it was. Yes, the beetroot, yeah.
Just as certainly my final word on this topic, Alex, the phrase, when the only alternative is total defeat, deferral feels like a victory, is what I will think every time I see an out-of-order sign on a train toilet.
Thank you. I'm glad you're taking it all in good humour here. I thought the reference to gigs with just one person in the audience that refuses to join in would have dampened your spirits. But nothing of the sort.
Alex, what does your spider sense tell you about the May elections? Do you think the voters are going to give the Tories a kicking?
I'm not sure, you know. I think there are stages to this reaction, and I think a lot of people will move to, they're all as bad as each other, and it will be a very low turnout, actually, before moving over to giving him a kicking. I mean, I might be wrong. It's also very easy to spin, as there weren't many seats up for re-election. The government always does badly on midterms, that kind of thing. I think it's the Wakefield by-election that will become the lightning rod, to be honest, because that is a proper red wall Tory Labour marginal. And if they get a really bad kicking there, then Tory MPs like Steve Baker, who under current polling is projected to lose his seat with an 8% swing, will start rethink. Yeah, it's a cheery thought, isn't it, Jason?
And as in North Shropshire as well, in Wakefield, the Tory has disgraced himself. So there's that element as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Desire to punish them.
Well, they all disgrace themselves, don't they, by going out and peddling these defences at the moment?
Well, you know, the ostensible reason why backbench Tories who are fed up with Johnson aren't acting yet is because they don't have any realistic alternative contender now that Sunak is also out of the running. And there was an interesting focus group, More in Common, out today. They talked to voters in Woking who were fed up with Johnson and they were, you know, disapproving about Partygate, but they asked who else is there. Is that going to be the big problem for disaffected Tories, or do you think they will start to coalesce around someone in the coming weeks ready for the post-election fallout?
I don't know, you know. I mean, someone always emerges in these leadership contests, don't they? Often it's not the person around whom people coalesce. You know, everyone thought that, if I remember correctly, that Portillo was going to be the sort of heir apparent to Thatcher, and he got nowhere. So I think when it comes to these matters of ethics, you have to have a red line. And the Tory MPs simply have to discover where theirs is, for Pete's sake. Is it one fine? Is it three fines? Is it organising an actual party? Is it going to a COVID ward and snorting coke off a patient? What is the red fucking line? And if they
that
find...
That wouldn't be a red line.
Yeah, that would be a white line. Thank you. And if they find that line, then they have to decide when he's crossed it and worry about who comes after.
When bills are rising and inflation is up, people start looking for ways to save money. And according to the market research firm Kantar, one of the things they're cutting back on is streaming services like Now TV and Disney Plus. Netflix and Amazon Prime didn't do quite so badly. People tend to stick with them. But have we got tired of binging and streaming? Jason, do you have any streaming subscriptions?
Yeah, I've got the usual suspects, you know, Netflix and Amazon and Apple and things. Obviously, being a person of a certain age, I subscribe to Disney Plus in order to get The Beatles Get Back, which is arguably the greatest 8 hours of TV ever made, and only 2 hours shorter than the entire recording sessions for the Beatles' first album. So I think I'm a sort of fairly kind of standard streaming candidate, really.
Are you watching less now that all the lockdown restrictions have been lifted and we can actually go out and, you know, see people?
Well, the problem is I was never allowed to watch much while I was locked down because there are other people. There's three people in this house who are ahead of me in the queue. So I tend to walk into the room when things are sort of already underway and I end up being the "who's that guy?" You know, so who's this? What's going on there? Walk into Severance a few episodes in and you are fucking through a trap door. You've got no idea what's going on at all.
Yeah, I am fed up with walking in, you know, some dinosaur is trashing a town in America.
That's how my mum reacts to television programs that she has put on and has been there from the beginning. And who's that one? You suggested we watch this.
It's great. It's a perfect analogue for the experience of waking up on the sofa, having fallen asleep during something and going, "What's going on? Who's this? What's that?"
Here, do you watch a lot of comedy on streaming services? You know, your competitors, your rivals, your friends. You're, of course, on HBO Max yourself, though I understand, is that right, not in Britain?
That is, HBO Max is a streaming service that is not currently available in this country, and I have a stand-up special on it, and I also have a girlfriend, but she goes to a different school, and you wouldn't know her. I have Shah Dots on HBO Max. If you're in America or do VPNs or weird stuff, then it exists. I think that streaming services have been a very good thing for comedy in general, which sort of makes sense, right? Like, compared to making an hour of content through filming film or doing an episode of a TV show, there are fewer moving parts. It's just a lot easier to do. You could make it all in a day doing two shows in a theatre. And if anything, we've become the victims of our own success in that stage. Like, people have become so oversaturated by the amount of stand-up that they can get on streaming services that they're probably, well, I'm never going to get through all of this, conceivably. So maybe we do need to pull back slightly.
Is it a good medium for comics? Bo Burnham's latest work on Netflix is actually, it's not something that could be done on a stage. As people, I mean, obviously there's a lot of there's not a lot of Netflix comedy that is comics on a stage doing a traditional performance, but are they starting to be more creative about it and do different stuff?
Yeah, perhaps. But I think sort of my favourite thing to watch as well as perform has always just been sort of just stand up and a person on a microphone on a stage telling me whatever they're going to tell me. And the fact that we can now access shows from people in countries we haven't been able to go to or performed years and years ago or that we thought we'd never get a chance to see and now are able to is a really, really wonderful thing, I think. So I think it is a good, certainly a good thing for comics and a good thing for the industry. And really, the only thing lacking is that there is only currently one Ahir Shah stand-up special available on the internet. And so anyone from a streaming service that ideally exists in this country, listen, I'll take BritBox if I have to, guys.
It would just cost them a fortune to CGI the audience.
Oh, that is cruel. I was at the recording, actually, of Ahir Shah's show on HBO Max.
We both were.
It was not a full house, but that was because of COVID. But I mean, is there a service that you would keep up streaming here, or have we already started cutting back in cost of living and all the rest of it?
Well, I've certainly had a look at it because you just think when you're reading headlines about sort of inflation at 7 million and what have you, and then you look at these direct debits that go out all the time, and I realise that for as far as I'm aware, I have a Now TV subscription that is used exclusively by my mother to rewatch documentaries about murders that she knows occurred at some point in history.
That's amazing.
You've solved this one, surely. Can we, and so I think that the one that I keep returning to is the one that is, well, I mean, I suppose you have to pay the television license, but is iPlayer. That's the one that I sort of keep using, and the one that, as I've been thinking, do I need all of these different things? I've thought, that is the one that I find myself using almost every day.
Well, that's lucky, because you have to pay for that one.
Yeah.
Alex, thinking about Netflix, I mean, it divides opinion. You know, our friend Ian Dunter, I believe, has struggles to find much on Netflix. Do you struggle to find things on Netflix that you want to watch?
No, I find loads of stuff on Netflix. And as a matter of fact, I was waxing lyrical the other day about how Netflix has opened non-Anglosphere things, a whole universe of sort of, Brazilian sci-fi and Korean drama. And I think it's blooming wonderful. But what I do is I alternate my streaming services. So I will do like 6 months on Netflix and then go off Netflix for 6 months and do 6 months on Apple TV, because I find that if I'm constantly on one service, then I do begin scraping the bottom of the barrel. Well, if I return to it 6 months later, there's loads of new stuff that I fancy watching. The one that's been a real surprise to me is Disney Plus. It's the one that I wouldn't have thought I would get much value out of. And I actually watch it more than anything, with the exception of BBC iPlayer, I think. Just because all the Marvel stuff, the Walking Dead stuff, they've got a deal with Star, so they've got quite a lot of sort of solid 80s, 90s films on there. And I like the animations that they put out. And they have things like the Golden Girls, which I love rewatching, especially if I'm feeling a bit poorly. But I get a lot of value out of Disney Plus that I wouldn't have expected.
What about All Four? Because that has a lot of foreign drama as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. I watch a lot of 4OD or whatever it's called. My partner paid for the subscription for it so that we get it without ads. And annoyingly, we still get it with ads. Because most of the time a voice comes on and goes, for contractual reasons, we still have to show you ads. So then they show you ads of other Channel 4 programmes and you think, what contractual reason compels you to interrupt Frasier and tell me to watch Four in a Bed? I feel I'm being fucked here. So we let that one go.
I really enjoy the ads. I know it's sad, but it's like a flashback to my youth when, you know, you were watching ITV or Channel 4 and there were ads and there was nothing you could do about it.
Well, there's a new kid in town. IMDb TV is available through Amazon and it's completely free, but they do ads in the middle. The ads are very, very quick. I think the ads are changing as well. I think they're really fast now. And so IMDb TV have various film zones completely free to everyone, and they do have a whole new series of Judge Judy, which is my guilty pleasure, only it's called Judy Justice now.
I have an ex-boss who at my leaving, leaving, gathering round the desk, said, "And boss, did you really remind everyone of Judge Judy?" And I've never forgotten
what?
That. It was horrific, anyway.
How?
I know, because I'm not that kind of person, but evidently...
In any way?
No. I just liked, Roz, when you were like, at my leaving not even a really, it was gathering around desks, and I expected you to say, and it was only for 9 minutes, actually, and I expected
and I didn't realise it was a leaving meeting.
Yeah. It wasn't that recent, but I'm not going to name the person involved. I would like to, but I won't. Now,
she's now Home Secretary or something, Ross.
You might have heard her name, but she's not Home Secretary. thank God. I have never worked for the Home Office. It might not surprise you to know. Jason, there's a bit of a... I sometimes find myself streaming something, and then I carry on watching it, and it's just absolute trash, and I'm still watching it, and I despise myself afterwards for watching it. And yet, do you ever have that thing where you regret streaming something, but you just get hooked by it?
Why do you do this to yourself, Roz? This is a terrible way to be.
Because you want to see how things turn out.
Well, I mean, it's the excuse, because as Alex says, it's great. There's a lot of French drama, and I use it as a kind of, I'm going to improve my French or my Spanish, and I'm learning Spanish, and I'm going to, you know, and I'm going to turn the subtitles off. And that's even worse, of course, because you just... and that's how I get into it. And I watch the most utter trash. There was a kind of... there was something called MILF that is in French on Netflix, which is, you know, what you would expect entirely. It's terrible. And I despise myself for watching it, but I did. But you don't, Jason. You don't have, I presume you have higher standards.
No, I was just trying to translate MILF into French and wondering what the abbreviation would be. And it got
so
long that I stopped trying.
Yeah.
like MJV.
MQJ.
No, I've not done that. I mean, Pace, having looked at the Jimmy Savile thing recently, which is hard to watch and hard to turn away from. It's that terrible seasick moment between those two things. I haven't really had that. I do have a sort of inside out regret, though, about this notion that people are starting to scale back on their streaming services, which is that if they start to have less money to spend, what are we going to miss? Because it occurs to me that as one of the early things I watched in the first lockdown, Tiger King, that surely there must be another impossibly alarming weirdo out there. Like, there's got to be another one of him out there. And if the streamers lose money and they can't afford to hang around for 2 years making a film about someone like that, we won't get to see it. And it's heartbreaking, really, for me to think that Joe Exotics is the worst hairstyle I'll ever see on television.
Have you written for streaming services?
I've written a bit for Netflix, yeah.
And what's it like? I mean, do you have to really make those cliffhangers cliffhangy? Is it more difficult?
Well, I haven't written drama for them, but the nice thing about what is happening, Jesse Armstrong, who's in charge of Succession, he's got the advantage. Anybody who does drama for streamers has got the advantage that they can pick up on what the box sets did, which was like you can now do stories where there are long stories and short stories, and they're all under the same umbrella. so that you've got a kind of, you've got TV which is kind of polyrhythmic, because there are things that last no time at all and there are things that are enormous and can last whole seasons. There, a few years ago, I went to an exhibit at MoMA in New York, which they had a Mad Men exhibit there, and under a big Perspex thing on a table, there were lots and lots of pages of Matthew Weiner's notes. For I think it was season 5 or season 6. And there were like 12 pages, 12 foolscap pages he'd written about Don Draper, about what happens to him. And by comparison, there was the character Pete. I don't know if you remember him. He's a little snake. Pete got 2 sentences at the bottom of one piece of paper that said, Pete starts nailing secretaries and eventually gets caught. He is now that guy. And that was his entire series arc over like 12 hours of TV. And it's wonderful that those two things can coexist. What streaming has done is taken the box set thing and said, and now it doesn't matter how long your episodes are. So your episodes don't have to be a broadcast hour, as it's called, which is about 43 and a half minutes. They can be as long or as short as you like, which is where you get something like, as previously referred to, the Beatles Get Back thing, where the episodes are of no common length whatsoever. They're just as long as it needs to tell the story. And a good example of that was Chernobyl, which was meant to be 6 episodes, but the writer said, no, I can do it in 5. I don't need 6. Just give me 5. It's fine. If I have 6, it'll outstay its welcome.
What a cracking thing that was.
Yeah, absolutely, wasn't it?
And that brings us to the end of this week's Bunker, which means it's now time for the panel's escape routes, what you've been up to in the past week to distract you from the horror show that is British politics. Alex, what's your escape route?
So I want to recommend Raw on Apple TV. I think it's wonderful. It's a series of sort of feminist, absurdist fairy tales. We reviewed it recently in the Culture Bunker and disagreed vehemently about it. I was right, they were wrong.
Is it like Angela Carter?
It's like, I'll tell you what it is, it's like a feminist Black Mirror. So each episode has a simple, absurd hook. So there are episodes like The Woman Who Lived on the Shelf, who is actually about a woman who gets married to this rich guy who builds a massive mantelpiece for her where she lives so he can look at her while he works. And little by little, he loses interest and starts to turn his desk the other way and she feels neglected. And they're kind of wonderful. Of course, my roof garden is beginning to wake up, all the little seedlings are beginning to pop their heads up, and so there's been much planting and potting and repotting and weeding and general joy. I think growing things is my mental health rescue remedy, so I highly recommend it.
Ahir, what about you?
So my shout-out is going to be for Gordon Ramsay's Future Food Stars, which, my God, it's excellent. So basically, I think that I've discovered that one of my favorite genres of programming is people competing for investments in their small business by doing challenges that have absolutely nothing to do with the running of a small business. And it's just like, you know, as someone who in effect does run a small business just of selling a weird thing, yeah, right? What you basically need to do is like, creativity in a limited sector that is quite rigidly defined, and then financial admin. What you don't need to be able to do is go on a zip wire in order to serve a meal to someone in the middle of a mountain rescue. And yet it is the most entertaining thing that you could possibly...
If you haven't read that delicious review of it in the Irish Times, I think it was.
Oh, I've not!
I highly recommend it. It's one of the funniest pieces of writing I've ever read. In fact, I will make sure the production team drop the link in the show notes.
Jason, what about you? What have you been doing?
Well, I'm going to be the happy sower to Alex's happy reaper. I get very attached to whatever seasonal foods are coming out around this time of year, because for the last few weeks it's been wild garlic, and I've been making absolute stack loads of wild garlic pesto, and now the asparagus has started to arrive, and so I'm now looking forward to all the asparagus meals. The other thing I've started doing is I started re-watching a bit of Fry and Laurie. which is a sketch series from the late 80s, early 90s, which remains astonishingly prescient and one of the funniest things I think I've ever seen. And I've just been dissolving in that in the last week and just laughing myself silly on a regular basis.
I hear you a Fry and Laurie fan.
I'm a Fry and Laurie fan, yes.
So you've been watching a bit of right? How about you, Rose?
I went on holiday, which was very nice. I went to the Peak District, one of my favourite parts of the world, and I went on a steam train. It was the first time I've been on a steam train since lockdown.
Really?
Yeah, it was great.
Last bit of coal, apparently. They're all going to have to... Because it was all coming from Ukraine.
I know, it's very worrying.
Or Russia, and, you know, the coal that those little locomotives use.
Oh.
So they're having big problem this summer.
So yeah, they'll just be in the sidings now, will they, for the summer?
Well,
Or they'll make you get out and push.
Yeah, it was lovely.
Welcome to global Britain.
There was shunting, and, you know, at one point they let off steam, and then it did this great sort of harping, hooting kind of thing, and oh, it was lovely. Aww. Lovely, beautiful.
Can we?
Steam.
There must be another way of producing steam. Could we drop Edward Lee in some cold water? That might do it.
And that's the end of this week's Bunker. Thanks to Alexandreou.
Thank you.
To Ahir Shah.
Thank you.
And to our special guest, Jason Hazley.
Thank you.
We'll be back tomorrow with another Bunker Daily and the full-length show, this time next week. If you like what we're doing, then you can help us keep doing it by supporting us on Patreon, the crowdfunding platform. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. Backers get a shout-out at the end of the podcast, and here are some now.
Best wishes from me to Rich Riddell, San Pellegrino, John Campbell.
It's a big thanks from me to Matt D, Rory Hipkin and John.
And best wishes from me to Yvonne Hewitt, Guy C and Chris Mitchell. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all next time.
The Bunker was presented by Ros Taylor, with Alexandreou and Ahir Shah. The group editor was Andrew Harrison. The lead producer was Jacob Jarvis. Get well soon. And the producers were Jacob Archbold, Yelena Sofronievich and me, Alex Rees, with assistant production from Alina Ganatra. Music by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.